Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. USU Assistant Professor of English C.R. Grimmer recently presented Sappho on Tour, How a Pop Star of Ancient Greece Influenced Modern Culture, for the USU Office of Research's Aggie Talk series. Professor Grimmer discussed the impact of that the Greek poet Sappho had on the ancient and modern world, from literature and lyricism to ideas of individualism, democracy, and desire. They also shared poetry from their new book, Poets as Public Scholars, Contemporary Poetics in an Age of Social Media. C.R. Grimmer is joining us today to talk about their book, the presentation, the poetry vlog, and other topics. C.R. Grimmer is an award-winning poet, scholar, and digital humanities educator whose work bridges poetry, public scholarship, and literary criticism. They're author of The Lyme Letters, Poems, which is the winner of the Walt MacDonald First Book Award, the chapbook, O as Equals Wife, and the peer-reviewed OEA multimedia book, Poets as Public Scholars, as I mentioned. Also, forthcoming book with Benjamin Gunsberg, A Writer's Guide to Multimodal Poetry. C.R. Grimmer joins us in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I guess, first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself. Born and raised in Michigan?
Yes, I'm actually representing. You all can't see it with okay. A never salty Great Lakes sweatshirt. I was raised in Troy, Michigan. It's a suburb about 30 minutes outside of Detroit, so in the Metro Detroit area. And I left at 22 to get my master's degrees in Portland, Oregon. I did my doctorate in Seattle and stayed there about 10 years and then came here.
All right. And so now you're near a always salty lake.
Yes, exactly. That's why I got the sweatshirt that says never salty.
Yeah. Kind of a different experience here.
Yeah.
Maybe that'd be a good bridge for us to jump into your book. We'll talk about Sappho a little later. Fascinating topic. So Poets as Public Scholars, in the introduction to your book, you talk about your experience growing up in Michigan there. And being interested, I guess, in poetry, but there being a disconnect between a lot of communities and the academic world. And I guess there probably still is a disconnect.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there were a couple disconnects, actually, that started really materializing for me when I lived in Seattle in particular. So when I lived in Troy, I was going to Oakland University for my undergraduate, and I was working and taking night classes, and that's when I started taking writing workshops, and one of my jobs was working in Detroit Public Schools through a nonprofit, and I would run writing workshops in those schools and ended up setting up a volunteer system with students at the university, and it just felt like even there, like between the public school itself in Detroit and the university, there were completely different languages used around poetry, there were different ways of approaching it. But there was a similar kind of emotional pull toward like what it would mean to be able to express yourself and get peer feedback and kind of finesse what language can do. I also felt when I moved to the West Coast that another layer of disconnect happened, where I realized there's this whole kind of community of poets. They differ regionally and they differ in different areas, but they share a language, right? Like they have podcasts that are by and for poets, right? You'll go to a poetry reading and people will use words you don't usually hear in other spaces. It felt like in poetry scenes, I would even say, or communities, there was sort of this openness and dialogue around difference and identity that I didn't experience growing up in a sort of small suburb of Michigan. And those differences felt more acute the further into the kind of west that I moved, if that makes sense, as well as how much further into academia I went. Other disconnects I started noticing were scholars of poetry, the ways they would talk about poetry versus how poets talked about their own poetry. And then I'd have my students who were a lot like I had been, who just really wanted to write poems and like get to know what poets are thinking. You know, they didn't need to be in any of these specialist kind of discourses, we would call it, right? Spaces where certain language is used to talk about things. So I was teaching at, during my doctorate and a little bit after, I was teaching at up to, I think at 1.4 different places. I was at South Seattle Community College, University of Washington, Bothell, University of Washington, Seattle, eventually Seattle University, before that at Portland State University. And I wanted to find ways to bring the kind of specialist cool poets into the classroom for my students in a relatable way. But I wanted the conversations to be available for people who grew up in areas like I did, where we don't have access to poetry readings and literature events and all of these kind of I would have called it as a young person highfalutin spaces, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted it to be more available, both for my students and for people who couldn't even maybe access the university. So at the time, that was 2018, YouTube seemed like a really good vehicle for that. Mm-hmm. I was like, I can have audio and video, and I can create these kind of episodes for people in different communities to access without feeling like they don't know what people are talking about.
Yeah. I want to talk about that disconnect, because you could do that broadly into any field of academia.
Yeah.
There's, you know, jargon. I deal with that on the radio.
Yeah.
When I bring professors in. And some professors, and usually the younger ones, but there's some pretty hip older professors. But some professors haven't got the memo, right? They're still speaking the jargon.
Yeah.
Right? And I tell them, well, you're not going to communicate effectively with the public doing that. So this is a version of that. But I want to take you back to the high school. You were teaching in high schools.
Oh, elementary school.
Oh, elementary school. Yeah. Oh, even better.
Yeah.
So there is a, I don't know, I think there is a perception of poetry as highfalutin.
Yeah.
and therefore a disconnect. And I don't want to go there from perspective of a child. I don't know if you encountered that. And
yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting with poetry because there's sort of almost two extremes that you encounter in the sort of common perception of it. One extreme is a sort of looking down the nose at slam poetry, performance poetry, mm-hmm. and actually hip hop and rap are the most formal poetry forms we have right now.
Yeah.
Right. So we actually, ironically, if you're in a less educated area, you grow up in a very poetry rich mm-hmm. space, if that makes sense. It's just not the type of poetry that academia tends to focus on, which we would call poetry with a capital P, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the work is sort of thinking about the history and relationship between popular forms of what I would say are poetry, and that might be even intentionally because of the ways they've been rejected from academia, don't even associate themselves with poetry proper anymore, and tying those into the poetry communities that have kind of expanded through social media, through like Twitter and TikTok and Instagram, where poets with a capital P, you know, are publishing text-based poems that aren't necessarily spoken word or slam or hip-hop or rap, but still gain a lot of traction. Like Rupi Kaur is a pretty famous one, where her book starts getting sold at like Urban Outfitters, right? And then you have some poets who are like, that's not real poetry, that's low poetry, and there's all these kind of inner debates about it. But it doesn't mean that it's not circulating in spaces that we don't associate with academia. Mm-hmm. It's more like, how does academia respond and interact with poetry in different forms and in different communities.
Yeah. Right. So that brings up a big question, which, what's poetry for? Right. And I guess you would say, and the people on your side would say, well, it's for everybody.
Yes, I would.
Right. But then the capital P poets might say it's just for our community. So I guess maybe have a crack at that one.
Yeah. I think everyone, if asked, would say poetry is for everyone. Mm-hmm. Right. I think the idea that we try to find new ways to reflect experiences through sound, which includes language, and find just the right words to kind of get at a feeling or an experience that might be beyond words. I think poets across all genres and identities would agree it's for everyone. Where I think the debate gets more trenchant, if that makes sense, is when people put more value in what they perceive as the craft of poetry. And that's where it can get pretty contested, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that my projects are very invested in breaking down that argument. I'm not necessarily interested in going to conferences and convincing academics about different forms of poetry. And I don't know if I'm convinced I need to go into Detroit Public Schools and convince them about different forms of poetry. I think what's more interesting to me is that in all of these spaces, there's a shared investment about what poems can do for how we kind of mm-hmm. experience each other and experience the world. But there isn't necessarily a shared language for talking about it across forms of poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's where I get more interested in it, if that makes sense. Or there's this idea that if you're an award-winning poet, academics might write a book about your poetry, and that's kind of celebrated. But then what about the folks who end up feeling left behind by that because they don't have access to that type of book style about poetry language, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So I'm a little more interested in that side of things than necessarily convincing people whether they should value different forms of poetry. There are professors that do that, and they're doing the good work, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. But I think for me, it's like, let's assume a baseline of interest and see what the barriers are to understanding and participating in the conversations.
Right.
If that makes sense. Or how can my poets see, or how can my students see poets as like real people? So if they're reading their book and then they see me talking with the poet just casually in a video, that can do a lot for students to see themselves as potential poets and realize, oh, like I could get published. Like I could be on the poetry vlog, right? I can connect to what this poet's saying. So they don't become like a sort of abstract, mysterious writer of godlike words, you know, mm-hmm. behind the page. They become like a real person, just like the student or just like you, mm-hmm. right? Who's kind of trying out what language can do and talking about it.
Yeah.
I hope that wasn't too sideways
a
response.
No, that was good. So just one more question on this, a very, very broad topic. So maybe you're a hip hop artist or you enjoy listening to hip hop or you go to a poetry slam. Are you having essentially the same experience as someone who's going to a quote unquote highbrow poetry reading?
Right. That's a really good question. I think it very much depends on who you are and what your identity grouping is, like how you identify in the world, right? Hip hop and rap. Let me try backing up here for a minute. One of the chapters in my book is with A.D. Carson, who wrote the first dissertation as a hip hop album or a rap album. It was a really big deal, right? It's already a big deal to take a dissertation, which is usually like a very traditional scholarly book with a lot of jargon, right? A lot of chapters talking about ideas through like peer reviewed research and instead create an art form. But to make that art form be rap is seen as kind of like taking what's perceived as a lowbrow culture and insisting that there's actually a lot of meaning that gets generated in sound itself, right? So he would say like one way to think of when we reference different scholars and we pull their ideas and we kind of recalibrate them to ours, it's kind of like sampling. Right? It's just a different form of it. So a lot of what AD is interested in and what we end up talking about was the history of academia distancing itself from the genres of like rap and hip hop, just as they became another form of poetry. And it was a very racialized genre, right? It was mostly Black folks that were making hip hop and rap. It was circulating more heavily in those communities. If they're not validated by academia as like a form of poetry, it's really hard to get a job like I have, right? You could publish like 10 albums and I could publish one book of poetry, but I got the job. Mm-hmm. And maybe the person that did the 10 albums, they're actually like a very densely intelligent, let me try that again. They're a very intelligent person who's crammed their poems densely, if that makes sense, with kind of extraordinary prowess, meaning kind of like ability to make sounds echo off of each other to create unexpected meanings, right? So there is a sort of political divide around what forms of poetry get validated by the institution or not. The same can be said for spoken word and slam. I think I talked about it in that chapter and throughout the book, where those communities came up because a lot of the sort of on-the-spot forms of poetry were seen as like not good for academia or not good enough. So people, especially the Puerto Rican communities in New York, actually formed their own spaces to make that. So I would say someone that's in those communities, they probably have a different experience of poetry than someone who's at a traditional poetry reading at a university, right? There's call and response that happens, right? So they'll kind of ask for interaction with the audience. There's sometimes a competition level to it. There's a sort of history that they pull from in each of their poems and each of their songs that's kind of unique to that space. So there is, I think, a different experience in either space, right? Either the academic kind of poetry reading or the kind of more spoken word slam and then also hip hop and rap kind of ciphers. But then your personal background and what you grew up with will impact how you experience that, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Some people traffic both and they do it really well. some people don't, and they're fine with it.
Right, right, yeah.
I don't know if that was too like convoluted.
No, that was great. So in your book, you say you're interested in coalition building.
Yes.
A more relational approach to creating knowledge. So I guess that led you to the poetry blog and then to this book. So tell me about the coalition building. What coalition are you interested in pulling together?
Yeah, this is actually a great example. If we go back to this, like different types of spaces where there's maybe a performance versus a poetry reading versus a cipher versus spoken word. Oftentimes in these spaces, a lot of folks are interested in the same ideas around justice and equity. Right. So I'm a queer poet and I'm white and I participate in poetry readings. My partner is Latina. Like I'm very interested in ways to make sure that everyone has livability right now and what poetry can do for that. I might not necessarily have the same background or same community spaces that A.D. Carson does. But we have a similar investment in kind of seeing what we can do so that more people can know that they are valued, right? And that they have safety and that they can live. So we might come from different places, but we can build a coalition together, right? Of we are invested in this similar project. What does it look like if we bring our work together, right? What does it look like if we kind of see where we diverge and respect that and where we overlap and can kind of collaborate? And so a lot of times in the book, I'm like, well, if I talk about someone like they're not here, that's not really a coalition. That's me just analyzing them like they're some kind of object, right? Whereas in a relationship, you ideally will exchange ideas, right? And you'll both walk away a little bit transformed by that. So it's like, what does it mean to try to do that in a book, right? To bring the poet in, talk with them, show that conversation, and then talk about the ways that their ideas are transforming an idea I have over here. And hopefully some of the ideas I have transform how we see what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So the relationship piece is just that, where it's like, these are living people and I want to be changed and change other people, right? We want to kind of build something new together. The coalition piece is very much like, where do we overlap in what we hope to see improve the world? And how can we kind of do that together while acknowledging and kind of even celebrating that we still have a lot of differences that we don't necessarily even need to reconcile. Like they can just be different and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. So the book, and again, we're talking with C.R. Grimmer, assistant professor of English at Utah State University. The book is Poets as Public Scholars, Contemporary Poetics in an Age of Social Media. So did the book come out of the poetry vlog?
You're
using elements from the poetry vlog. By the way, you can find the poetry vlog on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. It's very Googleable, thankfully. So it did. I created the poetry vlog, and at first, it was just a side project. I ended up creating, I think, 86 videos. I'd finished my dissertation. I was waiting on feedback, and I was teaching, and I was like, I'm just going to throw myself into this. And the resistance I encountered was actually in academia. So a lot of scholars were like, why are you on YouTube talking to poets? Like, focus on your research. Focus on your scholarship. You need to get more, we call it single author publications, where you alone are the author and it's an essay or a book. And I really took issue with that. Makes sense. I was like, I actually think that this is me doing my research. Like, this is the practice of everything I'm talking about, right? About relationships.
So public scholarship.
Yep. So public scholarship is the phrase people use. I think now we use community engaged scholarship sometimes. Digital scholarship is another word for when we use digital tools to engage with different publics is what they call it. So I was shopping around my dissertation and I met with an editor at University of Michigan Press and she was like, I actually think you could pull from the vlog and write scholarly essays explaining to academic audiences what these videos do and how they might be useful in their classrooms. So that the book became a way of translating the project for scholars, actually, and for students, and kind of helping them see, like, these videos might seem like just casual conversations, but here's some of the work they're doing in the jargon and language that you use in your academic community. So it kind of became another layer, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So this is an open book, accessible. Mm-hmm. It's got monographs, but it's also got videos.
Yes. I'll give the elevator version. So we've got seven videos featuring seven different poets and artists. It was important to me that some artists not seen as poets, right, are in it. And then each video has an academic essay or chapter attached to it that sort of explains that person's work and the conversation in the context of a particular scholarly field. Mm-hmm. The whole book is digital and free and downloadable through a special grant at University of Michigan Press. And that was so that they could make more academic work available to people who don't have access to higher education resources, which was obviously really important to me when I was putting the book out. I'm like, I don't want a book that only scholars can touch or access, if that makes sense. So anyone can go read it and watch it.
Right. So I assume you'd like to see much more of this. And access to, I guess, academic discussion, mm-hmm. academic ideas, research, public research in communities that wouldn't have access to this.
Yeah, of course. I think that for me, it's a given that knowledge should be shared as widely as possible and ideas should be so that people kind of can develop new ideas, right, based off what's out there for sure. But part of it is just a sense of belonging for people, right? Like these are poets that maybe don't come through Logan, Utah, but they do come through universities, right? So what does it mean to still be able to access those conversations? And these are scholarly conversations that happen in books that can cost upwards of $100. So what does it mean to try to read those conversations among scholars and see what you agree or disagree with? So I would say access is sort of at mm-hmm. the core of the project. It's a little odd to have a book you can't hold. I will confess to listeners, mm-hmm. it's very anticlimactic to publish a book.
Yeah.
It's more anticlimactic to publish a book that is not physically in your hands. Right. I was like, well, that happened, you know, but I think in terms of the ethos of like kind of sharing resources and knowledge as a resource, that's really important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but it's the world we live in, right? It's more and more. It's, for example, my reading. I don't pick a book up off the shelf. Yeah. I go to the ebook, you know. So I wonder, do you worry about in this form, it's more accessible, mm-hmm. and that's great. Do you worry about just in a poetry blog, for example, it's on YouTube?
Yeah.
Do you worry about this? These ideas that you prize, the research that you're doing, getting kind of lost in the cauldron of everything, including some very bad ideas and heated and not valuable discussions and, you know, the bad of the internet along with the good of social media.
Yeah. I mean, it's really vulnerable, right? 'Cause your likeness, meaning your face, your voice, is on the internet in a video. People feel like they have direct access to you. And you're asking poets and scholars that maybe a current culture doesn't necessarily value or like to be willing to put themselves out there too. And anyone can respond and anyone can interact. And with that could come some really unhappy responses. And I've certainly gotten them. But the way I see it is I can either continue to let the internet just be the internet and not try to put something that of value into it, or I can at least contribute from my tiny sesame seed of the world what I can, right? And I do believe that people who are interested in those conversations and who want to feel part of it, if they can find it, and I've had those emails come too where they're like, wow, I really felt like I got to know Jericho Brown, or it was really nice to be able to follow along with these poets I never thought I'd meet. That to me is even two or three of those emails is more valuable and kind of the goal of it than the kind of onslaught of just content for the sake of content or anger or debates. I always would tell the students I had working on the project, our goal isn't to go viral. Like these are never going to be, you know, 1 minute viral clips. And that's okay. We're not looking for like the largest number of views possible. That would be a very different project. A 20-minute video with a niche poet is never going to be that. Mm-hmm. But if there are people who want access to these conversations that get access, can, even if it's like a handful of people, that's more valuable for mm-hmm. what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. which is maybe counter to the way popularity and kind of viewership and listenership works on the internet. If that makes sense.
Yeah, certainly, you know, for a lot of people, going viral is the, that's the goal, right? So this is unusual, but you have a different purpose.
I do, and some of it's financial. So I see it as I have a lot of resources as a professor at a university. What can I do with those resources to share as much as I can, since I don't have to make money on it? right? Like my goal isn't to go viral so I can add in ads and get a sponsor and make a living off of it. And that is a privilege, right? So it's like, if I have that privilege, what do I do with it is how I see it, right? Whereas for some folks, there's nothing wrong with wanting to go viral and get more listens and views, and they might need it to make a living as an artist, right? If I don't have that pressure, what do I do with the privilege I have is how I see it.
Yeah. One more thing before we go to break. You said something I want to follow up on. So in the poetry vlog, and in the book, I think you feature some artists who are not seen as poets.
Yes.
Tell me about them. Give me an example.
Yeah. You know, Stevie Costa is probably the easiest example. She has her doctorate from the same program I went to, and she now runs a burlesque troupe, actually, in Seattle. And they do literary burlesque. It's called Novelties, right? And she actually did her research on burlesque and about the different, like, not the popular kind we think of that's, like, super salacious, right? But actually the underground version of it where people used it to sort of parody violences and culture that a lot of people don't know about that history. And I thought it was really interesting that she would host these events. She'd have poets and writers come up and read kind of performatively. And then they'd have burlesque troupe members do sort of like funny parodies of these literary characters. And it was a way of, again, pushing against that lowbrow, highbrow cultural divide. And part of that means performing language well, which is what poetry is kind of rooted in. It's just creating patterns and sounds so it's easier for communities to memorize and repeat, if that makes sense.
Yeah, interesting.
And she would never be at like a poetry reading as a poet reading, right? And so I was like, well, if I'm trying to push against some of the boundaries we also have in the poetry community, what does it mean to think about these kind of performance spaces that are doing similar work? It's that coalition piece again, but maybe aren't like validated by poets or academics. And she had some fascinating ideas, actually. Her essay might have been one of my favorite to write because it was so outside of my wheelhouse. I had to learn so much. And it changed how I thought about performance, actually, a good deal. So that would be the why and the who, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I said this was going to be the last question, but that's an interesting thing to follow up on. Tell me briefly how it's changed your view of performance.
I think that, like, I'm not someone who easily goes to parody and humor, and I think I'd been so steeped as a sort of 4 degrees of English major person that I thought of performance as theater with a capital T, and I hadn't really thought about ways that different bodies could play around with characters to sort of perform music and words for just like pleasure and fun and humor, and I didn't realize there was a history of that had been kind of that isn't what we associate with burlesque in like Vegas per se. So it was just a whole subculture of like, I would say poetry that I hadn't even heard of, which is saying quite a bit for how deeply I've been in the poetry world. And so it really did kind of just change what I thought was possible to do at a poetry reading, right? Or in performance, or even in a community who's just kind of interested in playing around with what we see in books or what we see as literature.
Yeah. It's also the interesting part of this, it connects back to history, right?
Yep.
She's bringing forward a historical form into modern times. Well, let's take a break. We're talking with C.R. Grimmer, who is USU Assistant Professor of English at USU. And we've been talking about her book, Poets as Public Scholars, Contemporary Poetics in an Age of Social Media. Also the poetry vlog. Poetry vlog is available. Also the book is available to everyone, Poets as Public Scholars. And they recently gave a presentation in the Aggie Talk series, Sappho on Tour, How a Pop Star of Ancient Greece Influenced Modern Culture. We'll get into talking about that following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with USU Assistant Professor of English, C.R. Grimmer, on the program today. Early in the program, we talked about their new book, Poets as Public Scholars. We also talked about the poetry vlog. You can find that on YouTube. And C.R. Grimmer is an award-winning poet, scholar, and digital humanities educator whose work bridges poetry, public scholarship, and literary criticism. They're the author of The Lyme Letters, Poems, and other books. So before we get into Sappho, I want to really talk about that fascinating topic. Let's talk briefly about that book, The Lyme Letters, Poems. I'm reading a quote you gave to USU Press is a different thing.
Yeah. I got you. Right,
yeah. Hopefully listeners got me as well. You talked to somebody at USU is what I'm saying. And here's your quote, previewing or coming after your presentation on Sappho. Poetry for me, you say, is about identity and the identities that are erased over time. My first book was looking at poetry and queerness, disabilities, letters to doctors, families, lovers, and pets. Tell me a little bit about that, especially that idea of erasure.
Yeah. Man, the Lyme letters, I think I started writing that in my MFA, so that's also like I'm not going to say how many years ago, right? But I was coming out of, all right, I'll get vulnerable here on the radio. I was coming out of a very religious family, and I loved biblical texts. Like I got really into theology. I was very interested in what language was doing and the stories it told and the meanings that we got out of it. As someone who ended up developing some disabilities and who ended up coming out as queer, I found it very challenging to reconcile my love for that with what I started learning about what is not included in sort of official stories, right? And it was as simple as wanting to know more about women that maybe would get like unnamed and barely mentioned. And I'm like, well, what is their story? Like, a prophet Ezekiel had a wife who goes unnamed, who gets killed as like a test, and then a verse later she's just dead, right? And all we really know is that she helped care for him during elaborate prophetic rituals. That's a whole life that's just kind of erased now. And I think that this is what happens with texts, kind of inevitably, right? Whatever we value is what we preserve at that time. And what we don't value is what we don't preserve at that time. And that can overlap with who you are and whether who you are is valued. So a lot of that book of the Lyme Letters was me sort of taking these texts and languages that were very much part of my growing up and who I was and asking what it would mean to try to write myself into them. And to write my body and my experiences into them. And also be okay with that being misunderstood, like not needing it to make sense to the kind of dominant view of the time, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of a paradox of trying to write yourself in while trying to allow, like being okay with it never being fully written in or understood or making sense. Right. Having a through thread is what we say in poetry, where A plus B you see very clearly equals C, and to kind of value that. So that's, I think, where my kind of early interest in the idea of erasure came from. And it was very personal, right, of trying to figure out where do I fit in this and how does text come together to make that possible or not.
So that is the Lyme Letters poems. Also, the chapbook, Oh, Ezekiel's Wife.
Yep.
I'm going to reference it to that.
You can guess what that's about.
Yes, for sure. By the way, since I mangled that earlier, I'll credit the writer of this article that I'm referencing, Kirsten Reither from Research Communications at USU. That's where these quotes are coming from you. So let's talk about Sappho. You're doing some work on Sappho. So remind us who we have a vague idea of who Sappho is in popular culture. And one of the things you're saying here is that Sappho has an ongoing influence. But first of all, the historical figure, the actual person, Sappho.
Well, I'm going to plug. And I'm reticent to say it because the last thing I want is more people seeing me on YouTube. But I will say there's a nice long video of Sappho through USC Office of Research now on YouTube. So I'm going to give the most abridged version right now. But if you're curious about a slightly less abridged version, I go in depth there a little bit more. Sappho has many different identities, But the one that is probably the most pervasive and common is she's seen as one of our earliest recorded women writers of poetry. She's the only woman poet in the Library of Congress. She's from ancient Greece. She lived most of her life on the island of Lesbos. And all that we have of her poems are now fragments because it was not a priority of the culture right after hers to preserve her texts. But at the time that she was alive, she was kind of like a Taylor Swift of ancient Greece. She invented a form of poetry. She was if not the first poet we have in the Western Hemisphere, in antiquity, we would say, who wrote about her personal physical experiences, internal, both like of desire and of love and of fear and sadness. That was actually very radical at the time to not write representing a collective, right? She also became ridiculed because she wrote about desire for women. At the time that she was popular, she wasn't ridiculed for it, to be very clear, but very soon after, right? And so she became a little bit of a contested figure as her poems were reduced to fragments instead of what we would say seven records of them, which is what she had before, seven albums, you could say, right? The kind of mystique around her increased. She was named one of the muses, I think the 10th muse, which is saying something because all the other muses were not actually mortal humans, right, for how much she inspired song and poetry. Every time she performed, it was with the lyra, sometimes pronounced as the lyre by some people, L-Y-R-E, which is basically like walking around playing a really good guitar to massive concerts, right? She was very influential in her time. And then her fragments and the mystique of her became influential continuously up until today. I'm talking a bit long here, but I'm going to end on her today now. We've talked about antiquity. Today, she is associated with the queer community. So poems would refer to Sappho and her lesbians, right? Which originally just meant literal lesbians, like women that lived on Lesbos. Nothing to do with desire. The ideas of desire and sexuality during Sappho's time could not have been more different than today's. It just doesn't map onto it. But she has become a sort of icon for contemporary queer communities of queer desire. So there will be like sapphic parties, they'll call them. And it's basically just safe spaces for women and non-binary and trans folks to have a good time and not be too worried about any violence coming in, right? She's celebrated as kind of the earliest records we have of women writing about desire at all, much less also for women. So she's kind of evolved, if that makes sense. The ideas about her and who she was are highly debated in academia. So everything I say today, know that it is a debate, if that makes sense, because we only have so much of her life documented.
Mm-hmm. Let me pick that up. So fragments.
Yeah.
Is all we have. So you're working on a project, the Digital Interactive Mapping Project.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I'm working on two projects, actually. Mm-hmm. The one I talked about in the talk is the Digital Interactive Map. I'm going to start with what came before that because it's what got me interested in this project. Because I'm not a classicist, which is the field where people would normally study someone in antiquity. I was working on my new poetry book where I'm writing letters again, right? And I wanted to try and echo the sounds of translations of Sappho in those poems. And I wanted to do place-based writing and try to get into the body or world of what Sappho would have been writing in. Because I was just really interested in kind of writing fragments layered after fragments, if that makes sense, and kind of trying to connect with this ancient idea or ancient writer. And when I went to Lesbos, I was like, there's going to be Sappho stuff everywhere. Like Sappho is so famous. There's going to be tourism shops. There's going to be statues. I'd been looking online and it was really hard to find things about Sappho and the island. And I was like, it's probably just in person. And I got there and there was very little, if anything. Like even in the archives, they had put her fragments that they had away out of public viewing. There were a couple of statues in her hometown that were unlabeled and made by men in like the 60s or 70s. Don't quote me on those dates, right? They're a little older. You go to Mytilene and there's some graffiti and there's a statue in the town square. You have to like hunt to find anything about her, which really shocked me. And I'm good at finding stuff. Like, it's my job as a researcher to find stuff. So if I'm struggling to find it and I'm, like, officially on the case, then it's hard to find. Conversely, what we found, especially in her birth town, that we believe is her birth town, Scala Ariso, which is like a little sea town on the opposite side from the airport in Main City, a ton of queer women, non-binary and trans folks holiday on Lesbos. So there is like a very active community of people that accredit their enjoyment of the island to Sappho. And there's a lot of misinformation about Sappho that begins to circulate when people don't have any official records or anything they can kind of reference. So we ended up making some friends, and they all needed to find Sappho as well. And I was like, what if you could come to the island and take a driving tour with a map and learn about Sappho, and it wouldn't be tied to a physical space so anyone could do it? And that's how the project came about.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about the poems that you're doing, that you're working on. So you were interested in the sounds, you said.
Yeah.
What the sound of Sappho in Greek?
That is the money question.
Yeah.
So I'm so worried I'm going to go too in-depth in the time we have. Uh-huh. Let me see if I can give the fastest version. Okay, so I am very interested in sound in part because my parents were the music directors and music people of our church, and my mom was a piano teacher. I grew up around it. That's my interest in poetry. And in poetry and in language, we have stress patterns. Sappho's poems have been translated into English by many people, and Carson has a translation in English that I find particularly evocative and interesting. And the Greek is on the other side of the page. So I wanted to know what it would be like to take my poems, try to imitate the stresses or sounds of Anne Carson's translation in English, and see it as kind of like a echo, like a translation of a translation, right? If there's all these layers of erasing, right, what does it mean to work from that top layer that we have? And kind of play around with that and think about how you're another echo of it instead of pretending that I can in any meaningful way genuinely sound like Sappho. Like, we have no audio recordings of Sappho and Sapphic meter, right? So that's where it's maybe a little highfalutin to go back to that word in terms of the idea of it. But in terms of practicing it, it's the opposite of highbrow. It's very much a feeling, like the way that you breathe when you read, if that makes sense. And how does it change the way you experience language? I don't know if that's helpful or a little too convoluted.
No, it's very interesting. So more of a feeling, more of an instinct.
Yeah. And breath. Breath would be key.
Breath,
right?
Yeah.
Every time you speak, you breathe out, right? And then you breathe back in. And the amount of force, you breathe more. And when we have stresses on certain words, it changes the way that you're breathing while you speak, which can change how you feel.
Yeah.
I just think that's fascinating. Like, it's just beautiful.
Well, and that puts me in mind of music as well.
Yeah.
Which is obviously, you know, the force of your breath, the breaths you take, the rhythm.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit more about that. You know, the influence you feel that early experience of the church music has had on your poetry.
There's a book called Black Pentecostal Breath that I think really gets at it better than any book I've ever read. Because I was raised in the Pentecostal church when I was younger. That includes speaking in tongues, right? This idea of song. Breathing, like the way that you kind of lose your breath because you're so enraptured, right, in a moment. And there's a sort of shared experience of it in the room, right, where you're like your physical body changes as you breathe differently, as you make different sounds. And that can be a really powerful form of knowing something intrinsically that you struggle to put into words. Right. I find that moment where it's like, I don't know if I have the right words for this, but I know how it feels in my body when I try to say it. That fascinates me. And trying different like rhythms and different patterns with just language, like stripped away from music, and seeing if I can replicate some of that feeling that maybe goes beyond a single word, if that makes sense, which is kind of the oldest trick in the book with poetry, technically, right? So ancient poetry was always in a form that had repeated rhythms because that made it easier for people to memorize it and repeat the stories because they didn't have a printing press. So there's a sort of like beauty to me in that kind of practice of both like understanding something on like an intrinsic or kind of an inner level, but not being able to explain it in a rational language level. And where does poetry come to meet that, if that makes sense?
Definitely. I want to go back to translation. I'm fascinated by translation. There's so many ways you can. It's an art. Definitely an art. It's science too. You have to know both languages very, very well. So you're doing kind of an echo of a translation, or in a sense, a translation of a translation in a different way. So first of all, I want to ask you: is there come to be accepted? This is the best translation. So Ann Carlson's is the best of Sappho.
I don't know. People,
there are debates, right?
There's always debates in academia, especially around Sappho, because we do believe she was married, she had a daughter. People aren't sure then, and then she had a brother. These things are always debated, and then if you add on translation. Some people, they want it to be as clinically close as possible. Some people want it to be as sonically close as possible. Like it sounds more similar versus the word is perfect. Some people think it should be translated into language that we understand today better than maybe the perfect word for it, so that people get the idea of it better. So I think it's part of the beauty of translation is that it's debated, right? It kind of forces you to think about what parts of language matter to people. I just prefer Ann Carson's translation. I think it's the way that she uses white space to show the fragments and the way you can see hers next to the Greek, and then the kind of way she balances sound with the clinical meanings is just really evocative to me. It's very – I'm emotionally drawn to it and just find it enjoyable to read and to look at. But there are other translations that are wonderful. They're just not my style.
Mm-hmm. Very much like music or theater, or it's choices.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So you said some people like the exact, I guess, meanings of the words. Others want to go for the sonic.
Yep. And I'm not a translator, so I don't want to butcher the field at all. It's an entire discipline that is really fascinating. But I think that's one of the biggest debates in translation is how do you echo the feeling of the words as much as the word itself? I had a colleague send me a translation she'd done, and in Spanish it was gorgeous. In English it was so clunky. And she was like, how can I keep this general meaning but make it sound more like the Spanish idea, like the idea in Spanish? And that took like a day, and it was just a couple sentences of me like tinkering with the sound. My partner speaks Spanish, thankfully, and asking her to say things in Spanish and kind of break down what it would mean. So it's almost like a puzzle, but it's a puzzle where you sort of pull the curtain back on what meanings people choose to keep or drop.
Yeah. Just a couple minutes left in the hour. So what are you working on now? Are you working on this book of poems?
Yes, I'm working on the book of poems. They're actually all drafted, so I'm in the revision stage. It's a four-part book, and each part is after different aspects of wildfire seasons, actually, because I also struggle with that on Lesbos. And they'll hopefully be done in the next year or two, and then I'll start shopping it around. And then the mapping project now has, I think we're up to 6 collaborators. So I'm working on grants to return and start building a prototype that we can hopefully test out, if that makes sense, with the different connections we've made on the island. So those are the two big projects at the moment. They are both around Sappho, but I think both more so like translating Sappho today and then keeping her work and her ideas alive for anyone to access.
Well, we'll look for both of those.
Thank you.
We've been talking with USU Assistant Professor of English, C.R. Grimmer, who recently presented on Sappho for Aggie Talks series, working, as you heard, on a book of poems based on echoes of translations of Sappho, right? And then this mapping project, digital mapping project. Also, you can find the poetry vlog on YouTube, and the book is out and available to anybody, poets as public scholars. Also, the Lyme Letters poems and O, Ezekiel's Wife, those are all out there as well. C.R. Grimmer, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was really fun.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.